Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Donald Trump experience, that it's such a perfect little vignette there where he doesn't want to be prepared on national security matters because he's worried about this like oblique press coverage angle in how he's treated.
And Andrew, there's a deep state of intelligence officers briefing him that are then going to leak something from the meeting. So he doesn't want to be president of this country and lead this government because they're a deep state out to get him.
Can I intervene and beg to differ? I am so glad he's not getting the security briefings.
Hi there, and welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable podcast. I'm your guest host, Andrew Egger, filling in for Mona Sharon, who's off this week. Joining me, as always, are our regular panelists, Linda Chavez from the Niskanen Center, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal. Damon Linker's off this week as well, but fortunately we've got my colleague A.B. Stoddard sitting in. Some of these people planned their vacations before they knew the DNC was not going to be, you know, the funeral march to doom in November. That's okay. Joining us live as well from the Windy City is our special guest this week, Samuel Benson, who is national political correspondent for the Deseret News. Thank you one and all for joining us. So Sam, you're on the ground in Chicago at the DNC. I want to start with you. A few months ago, here is the script that I maybe would have drawn up for how this convention was going to go. You have Joe Biden in there running for re-election. He was going to basically give us a whole convention themed around a phrase that he used to like to use a lot. Don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. It was going to be, sure, you know, in the background, yes, I'm historically unpopular, but we just can't risk Donald Trump getting back in there again. He was going to be under the gun making that case because he was losing to Trump in every poll. And it seemed very possible the whole thing was going to get swamped by a monsoon of you know, dissident left protesters against Biden's handling of Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. And instead, the vibes have completely shifted since then. We're in a situation where everything seems to be peaking at the right time for the Democrats' new nominee, Kamala Harris. She's up in the polls. The party's unified behind her. She's got former Republicans and progressive darlings all up there singing her praises on the main stage. Can you just talk to us a little bit about the energy on the ground? What has stood out to you so far at the DNC?
I think vibes are a good way of putting it. There's this general sense that this is a whole new election. When President Biden made his appearance on Monday, he was well received. He was thanked, and he's been thanked repeatedly by speakers, including Speaker Pelosi, who spoke last night and thanked him profusely. But in many senses, Biden here is an afterthought, and the focus is completely on Harris and on walls and what their administration could mean for the future. A lot of journalists, I think myself included, are interested to see what Vice President Harris's speech will be tonight, how much she leans into her policy platform, if at all. And what that discussion looks like. But in the time being, as I speak with delegates and I speak with attendees, there's just this overarching sense of hope and of joy, just kind of the messages that they're pushing over and over. It's interesting that you mentioned the protesters, though. The DNC has done a really interesting job in keeping protests to the north of the arena, to the point that the media entrance on the south, unless you're looking for it, media isn't even encountering these protests when they enter and exit the arena. That's a logistical strategy, I assume, that's been fairly successful, I think, in separating the media from what's going on the outside. It's a different conversation downtown at McCormick Place, where another secure perimeter is and where there are more protests. But for the most part, the DNC, I think, has made a concerted effort to keep those two things separate and focus on what's happening inside the arena.
Yeah. So you mentioned, as you say, you know, Kamala Harris is going to speak tonight. And Bill, we're in kind of an awkward spot taping this podcast. It's Thursday afternoon. We're going to publish tomorrow morning after the speech. So, you know, it has already happened by the time all of you people out in TV land are hearing us. But I did want to ask you, you know, a lot of these good vibes, they've been sort of rolling forward largely around the idea of Kamala Harris. Damon talked last week about how she's been able, much more so just because of how this whole situation's shaken out, she's been able to kind of run as generic Democrat. You know, it's kind of the old cliche is nobody gets to run as the generic. Well, she kind of has. And it's worked really well for her. Tonight, she's going to have the spotlight. It won't be the idea of Kamala Harris. It'll be her up there in corporeal form. What does she need to do tonight, in your opinion, Bill, to keep the momentum going for her?
Well, a survey I saw just yesterday indicated that more than a third of Americans have essentially no idea of who she is or what she stands for. So it seems to me that job one is filling in enough of the blank canvas so that people understand who she is as a human being, where she came from before she burst into their consciousness for the first time, and in a very rough and ready way, her sense of where she would like to help take the country under her presidency. I doubt very much that a lot of the speech is going to be devoted to wonky details. God knows at some point, you know, she's going to have to put more flesh on what has been, from an issue standpoint, a very bare bones campaign. There was a little bit of information last Friday about her economic platform. And I think the whole world knows where she stands on social issues. There hasn't been a word about foreign dangers, you know, or America's role in the world. And I guess I would guess we won't hear much of that tonight either. But at some point, she has to fill that in. But mainly, I think her job is a very basic one. I know for a fact that she has skilled speechwriters. She has, you know, she's demonstrated, I think, some chops in delivering set piece speeches. I expect it to be a capable speech, in spots an inspiring speech. If they're smart, they will also do a little bit of defensive work. I mean, her vulnerabilities have not been that much in evidence, and the Republicans have done a very bad job of focusing on them in the 4 weeks since she became the nominee. Yes, just 4 weeks. But I think she would be well advised, you know, to pound away at the price control or price reduction portion of her economic platform, and also to stage a preemptive attack on what is sure to be a major Republican line of attack on immigration. Beyond that, I have no idea of what she's going to do.
So I this is a thing I've been kind of rolling around in my mind a lot too, because obviously one of the things that one of the main pieces of kind of press chatter around Kamala and you know, a centerpiece of a lot of Republican attacks is, well, when is she going to roll out, you know, some of these specifics? She wants the job of president. When's she going to tell us, you know, in a lot of detail what she hopes to do when she's in the captain's chair? But I guess I do kind of wonder, like you say, at some point she'll have to do that. At some point she'll have to roll these things out. But I mean, does she actually, like, is there a real electoral pressure for her to do that? Or I mean, I'm curious, again, just to come back to you, Bill, on what you think. Is there an argument to be made that from a pure kind of like political standpoint, she might be better served to try to keep the generic label going as deep into this thing as she possibly can?
Look, this may be the first successful laisser les bon temps rouler presidential campaign in history. That would represent a bet that the vibes campaign of the past 4 weeks, you know, can continue for the next 75 days. It's possible that that could happen. But if I were running her campaign, I wouldn't want to bet the farm on it. I'd want to, especially for someone who, as I said before, has burst onto the national scene, was, you know, did not go through 18 months of primary vetting, you know, has not learned what works and what doesn't, has not really figured out how to present in a punch effective way some of the key issues. I would want to do some of that. Otherwise, you're just betting, you know, that the politics of joy will carry you through to victory. And look, I've gotten old enough. You know, so that I have learned the hard way to suspend my priors. Maybe that can happen. But with so much to lose, as I said, I wouldn't want to bet everything on it. I wouldn't operate under the assumption that any policy specificity does more harm than good by offering a new attack line. I just don't think that's true. But of course, you know, I've never been a political director of a presidential campaign. I have been a policy director of a presidential campaign. And so this just may reflect my history and my biases.
Well, I think they should make more of you policy guys, let you run the whole show. Linda, let me ask you.
You're talking to the co-creator of Walter Mondale's tax increase pledge. Right. Keeping me away in droves might be the best part of wisdom.
from your lips to God's ears, maybe. Who knows? So Linda, let me ask you. Traditionally, we've seen, usually in these cycles, parties get to put their best foot forward at their convention. They see a polling bump as a result. This cycle has been so weird in so many respects. Republicans had their convention where they felt so unified. They felt great. It was, I mean, talk about a good vibes convention. They had one. And then all the air kind of came out of that balloon instantly, because immediately coming out of that convention, Biden stepped aside, Harris stepped up. They sucked all the oxygen out of the room, and it's been all Harris-mentum, all Kamala-mentum ever since. So I'm curious what you think will be happening coming out of this convention. I mean, it's been, as we've said, very tight. They've stayed on message. They've been unified. Do you think things return to norm here, revert to norm here, and Democrats do get that bounce additionally to the bounce they've already been getting that we've historically seen? Or are we so far off the known map that it's hard to predict that kind of thing right now?
I think they will get a bit of a bounce, but I'm with Bill partly, not entirely, on the policy question and whether she has to really address that. I think speaking more generally on her policy objectives is better than laying out, you know, white papers. I don't think that's a good idea. On the question of price reduction, that is a big issue. I mean, we can cite the statistics on inflation, you know, till the cows come home, but it's not going to convince Americans who still feel they are paying too much at the grocery store. And I think, you know, her attempt to do that on the price gouging issue was really ham-fisted. You know, I'm sorry, you know, it does reflect my corporate background, but I've actually sat in the boardroom and had pricing discussions and know how prices are set by companies. And, you know, it isn't, oh, gee, here's our open door and let's just jack them up as high as we can. That isn't the way it's done. And when you're talking about groceries and you're talking about grocery chains in particular, they have such low margins. I mean, you're talking about under 2% margins. So they aren't the problem. The problem really has been more the supply chain and getting the availability. And this is where I would advise her to go, which is, yeah, people are worried about prices, but wait till Donald Trump comes in and puts a 20% tariff on all goods from China, but also from other countries. You want to talk about a price increase, that would be a real hit. And so I would rather she play a little more offense against Trump on this issue. I also think that immigration is clearly an issue. The numbers are way down right now. They've dropped, you know, to a real low point to what they were essentially before Biden took office. But there isn't a solution yet. I've described what Biden did as a Band-Aid, and it is, and it will work for a while, but it won't work in the long run, and that Band-Aid is going to come loose. So she does have to be aggressive on it and proactive on it, and I think she's done a very good job so far. I think her commercial on immigration was absolutely right, and again, she can go on offense against Trump and his failure to get the job done, and his having killed the bipartisan deal. So I think Viola is also right on the foreign policy front. I had lunch yesterday with some of my closest friends. We have a book club, and these are all the kind of people that she needs to get to vote for her. They're all either Republican or former Republicans. And what they're worried about is what's she going to do in the Middle East, not just on Israel. And thankfully, the Wednesday night appearance of the hostage parents was, for me, the high point of the evening, and the reaction of the crowd. I mean, those parents were worried that they were going to get, you know, silence, or they were going to get pushback from the audience. They got tears. So, she's got to be, she cannot come across as, in any way, I think, pro-Palestinian Hamas. And I think she has to be clear that there's suffering in Gaza, but that suffering is because Hamas is continuing to fight and put civilians at risk. But she also has to talk about the other big threat, and that's Iran. And I don't know that she has to do it in this speech, but people have to get confidence. People who are, you know, not Democrats, who are independent, who really don't like Trump, but who are very worried that she is both a little softer. She's got to show she's tough. She's got to show that she can stand up to Vladimir Putin. And she has to take some credit for and lean into what Biden has been able to do on the NATO front and in working with our allies. So she's got a big job ahead of her, and it's not an easy one. She can't avoid policy forever. Vibes will take you a long way. Enthusiasm will take you a long way, but it won't take you over the finish line if there's not a little substance there to back you up.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, the interplay of this Vibes election and then the policy election that we are still likely to get, you know, this very foreshortened policy election we're still likely to get in a minute. But I wanted to come to you for a second first to ask about something slightly different, because one thing that has really struck me coming out of this convention and especially coming out of the Republican convention a few weeks ago is we've now had two conventions, both of which the people on the ground felt super, super good about their chances coming out of it. And just to get a little dark for a minute, I mean, I think it is kind of an ominous thing to have so many Republican voters going into this election so sure that it's one that they've got in the bag, right? Because that kind of pre-primes them in a lot of ways yet again for, should Kamala Harris win, another round of Trumpian allegations of a stolen election. And you wrote for our Morning Shots newsletter this morning about how Trump is already out there on the campaign trail, you know, once again, pre-priming the pump for this sort of thing, talking about how we already know we've got the votes to win it. We've already got that part in the bag. We just need to make sure that they're not going to cheat. So what are you seeing out there with this? And is that a worry for you as well?
Yeah, I think it's not new. Trump has said this actual line before, that we have all the votes we need. But it's the only people that really know that probably are people are paying attention at the granular level like we are. So I think the average voter is really good that they showed a great, wonderfully produced video about January 6th, had Benny Thompson speak last night, the congressman from Mississippi, who chaired the House Select Committee on January 6th. Nancy Pelosi talked about it. Andy Kim talked about it. You had an emphasis on it for people outside the party faithful, the activists, you know, people at home, to kind of remember this threat and to take the warning from Thompson. Then he's at it again and he's plotting again. I just think that, first of all, you've stolen my low light for the week. So instead of going to me at the end, we'll just skip me. But yes, I am very concerned about this. And I think getting it into the mainstream of the political debate is absolutely imperative. An imperative for the party. And I don't think that Harris will be doing it from any podium or in any arena. And that's why it's really incumbent on everybody else to make sure the average voter understands that Trump is going to do this unless he wins. guaranteed. He's promising it. He's projecting it. He's telegraphing it. They're drawing up the plans. They've devoted unprecedented amounts of resources to it. And he is going to do the same thing he did before. It'll be different. He's not president. It'll look a little different, but it'll start at the county level in swing states where Republicans, radicalized by the big lie, will refuse to certify the election. And even if you do that in a county Trump wins, you stop the state certification and then the national certification. So it's in the works. Everyone's planning on it. And I just think it's important for Democrats, starting next week when the happy times at the United Center are behind them, to start talking about this. It's dark and it's ominous and it's horrible, but Michelle Obama alluded to it. They need a big margin. They need to run up a big margin. The closer the election is, the more potential we have for he's going to lie either way, but for violence and to getting to a dangerous spot in terms of a constitutional crisis. So it's really essential that this become amplified by anyone listening to this podcast, anyone who's following this election and cares about the outcome, really needs to make this a part of their conversation with their friends and their neighbors about people's voting plans. Do you know where you're voting? Do you know when you're voting? And the people who are on the ground energizing to knock on doors, mobilize, register voters. This is absolutely has to be the headline of these conversations, not how great is her latest poll, but we know we have this threat coming and we have to run up the score.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a thing that I have had a hard time getting my brain around a little bit, because one of the critiques of the Democratic Party since the handover, under Biden as well, but kind of since the handover to Harris of the proceedings at the DNC so far, it's been this kind of like glide path strategy, right? It's been the kind of shunting the media to the side, and giving a big pride of place at the DNC to, you know, a whole stable of fellow traveler social media influencers who are just kind of like force multipliers on the vibes. I think a lot of people in the press have had fair, genuine questions about a lot of that stuff. Like, hey, like the role that we play here matters. We're supposed to be able to kind of like independently vet the candidates and not let you guys set all of the terms of all of the conversations and all of the atmosphere. The party shouldn't be able to set all that stuff. You need these outside observers to do it. At the same time, you know, the stakes are extremely high in all the ways that you allude to. So I guess I wanted to come back to you about this a little bit, Sam, because again, I know you're on the ground and I know there have been a lot of kind of press concerns about just the way things have gone logistically at the DNC so far. Again, kind of feeling like the traditional news media is sort of an afterthought there. There's kind of this vibe among a lot of Democrats on the ground that the media is just out here trying to find some fly to put in the ointment of the good Kamala Harris vibes parade. I'm curious what you make of all that and what your experience has been sort of like navigating all that on the ground in Chicago.
Well, I think your assessment that the priority has been, you know, these content creators, these social media influencers over the traditional press, I think is accurate. And there's been a ton of consternation about that. Max Tawney at Semaphore had some good stuff on it earlier this week, where there were some formal complaints made by traditional media to the DNC that were just kind of blocked or ignored. They have a sitting just like in any convention, really high up in the third concourse. But they have this stage, as you've probably seen on TV, of social media influencers that are right on the floor, that have access to surrogates, that kind of have the red carpet rolled out. And I think it is part of this much bigger strategy on the Harris campaign's part to access young voters. They recognize that young people aren't going to be picking up the New York Times every morning or flipping on cable news like perhaps older generations do. But I think it also gets at the bigger question you're asking, Andrew, of is the Harris campaign trying to push its own narrative and not allow the press to, you know, get in front of the wagon if the horses are the press in this instance. And I think it's interesting because it is difficult, right? The role of an independent and free press is to ask questions that are important to the American populace at large, especially in the election cycle. And if the Harris administration is engaging a lot with content creators who are able to push these vibes but not ask questions on, you know, policy, as you brought up, Bill, or foreign policy, as you said, Linda, I think that is a legitimate critique to make. I will say, I had a conversation earlier this week with a former senior advisor on the Kennedy campaign, who's a 23-year-old TikToker, but Kennedy brought him on to push their social media strategy. And even he was critiquing the Harris strategy, saying that when you have, you know, these dances or these things about, you know, coconut trees and whatnot, and you're not mentioning anything really that would benefit the life of an 18-year-old who's, you know, scrolling on TikTok or Instagram, you're perhaps missing an opportunity to push out bits of policy. But that just goes back to the critique that the Harris administration really isn't even pushing out bits of policy aside from her economic policy speech last week. So I think they're legitimate critiques, and there's a lot of frustration from the press in Chicago on that front.
So Linda, let me ask you about this, because on the one hand, nobody is, you know, going into a story like this particularly sympathetic to hearing the media grumble about how badly the media is being treated, to hear the media talk about how important the media is in all these situations. On the other hand, you know, you could make the case that Democrats are sort of shooting themselves in the foot here by leaning so much into only talking to very, very intense fellow travelers, to in kind of the content creation space, to just act as a force multiplier on these party generated vibes, instead of offering independent assessment of the campaign, you know, instead of assessing what Harris stands for, what she's likely to accomplish in office. What do you make of all that, Linda?
Well, it was really interesting watching the commentary last night. And because it is my duty to watch Fox News once in a while, so our listeners don't have to, I switched over to Fox after the Waltz speech to see how they reacted, because they are obviously going to be the most hostile, or not the most hostile, but certainly among the big time players. They're not going to be friendly to the DNC. And it was pretty good. On the other hand, watching both MSNBC and CNN, I didn't watch the networks, but I watched the cable networks. They've been over so much to be almost fellow travelers of the Democrats that I'm not sure that's great. I think they need to be a little more objective. They should not look like cheerleaders, because I think it then undermines them when they're critical of Trump. So, you know, I'd like to see even-handed coverage. I don't want to see hostility, you know, but the fact that she hasn't yet given an interview, I understand why they haven't. Why mess with the good thing that's been going? But she will eventually have to answer questions, and she needs to do more of that, because that's how, you know, first of all, if she's traveling around the country, she's got to get on local TV. That's what people really watch. I mean, ordinary Americans who aren't political junkies, they turn on the local news to get the weather report and, you know, sports and other things. And what's happening in their downtown areas. And so she's going to have to do some of those. And I hope she's been spending this time getting some media training on it, because she's not been great in one-on-one interviews. And I know, you know, again, for the undecided voters, that's going to be important. It's not just going to be the political ads, which people can very conveniently tune out. Yeah, a whole lot of Americans are on social media, but the most reliable voters are older Americans, and they are not necessarily watching TikTok, or even if they are, their feed may not be including the material that will be, you know, helpful on this. So the media is going to play a role, and let's hope it's at least a neutral role, because I think if they are trying to be helpful to the Democrats, that's going to sour some people. And is not necessarily going to be good for her.
Yeah, and Bill, I mean, we go kind of around and around on this stuff, you know, trying to game out whether this very tight, locked down, soft focus strategy will help or hurt Kamala Harris's campaign in the long run. But also, I mean, just looking beyond the campaign, isn't it true that that Kamala Harris sort of has an obligation to the American people to before they ask her to pull that lever for her, to really level with them about what all that's going to entail, what all that's going to imply, what it means for their lives in the country, you know, as we go into a possible Kamala Harris administration?
Obligation is a word I would use. Whether or not it's a word or even a concept that a majority of the American voters are going to use, I think is a different question. And I am antiquely focused on campaigns as preludes to governance. The more some of these questions are vetted in advance, the sharper the incoming administration is going to be in, you know, being able to articulate its case, understanding the weaknesses and pitfalls, learning how to take those into account. So, yeah, you know, from my old-fashioned, wonky standpoint, obligation is the right word. But the electorate gets to make the call on that. How much is enough to satisfy them that they know enough about her to pull the lever? I can state that question, but damned if I can answer it. But talking about the press dimension of this for just a minute, my experience is twofold. Number one, the traditional media, particularly the major national newspapers, and I'm not just saying this because I work for one of them, do have an agenda-setting influence that hasn't gone away. There's a sort of a trickle-down effect of articles in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc. Which brings me to my second point, and that is, it's my experience that if you try to keep the media away, they will get more and more frustrated. They are more likely to pile on you when the inevitable stumble or speed bump develops in your campaign. So the strategy that's being employed right now has all of the advantages front-loaded and the potential disadvantages following up. I am, you know, once again, you know, as someone who's somewhat risk averse and who believes in trying to protect yourself against contingencies, I would advise the campaign, not that they're listening, to shift towards openness pretty soon after the convention ends. She has said publicly that she will do at least one major interview before the end of the month. That would be a good start. But I hope they do more than that so that the media doesn't feel so excluded from what's going on that they will jump on the first problem.
Yeah. AB, can we talk a little about, I feel like the other side of the equation on all this is the unbelievable kind of like gravitational distortion field that is the Trump campaign, where because of the stuff you were talking about a minute ago, because the stakes are so high in this campaign, it does create, just in terms of keeping that guy out of there, it does create this much broader than usual permission structure for somebody to run on the Democratic side as, look, isn't the main thing you want somebody who will keep him from coming back in and just kind of running wild again? But at the same time, I kind of struggle with that because, like, you don't want necessarily the bad behavior of Donald Trump on the Republican side to get Democrats so comfortable with kind of like taking this easier path, this glide path, this vibes path, that you know, it has knock-on effects long after Trump is gone. So I'm curious what you make of that, of trying to run this campaign that's like good on the merits in all the ways that we're talking about and functional on the merits in all these ways that we're talking about, while running against sort of like the horrible grotesque figure of Donald Trump on the other side.
Well, I agree. I agree with Linda. No white papers required, but there is a way. I also agree with Linda that we talked about it several weeks ago on this program. Her border ad was great. It was almost like went on the offense. It answered the defense. It was slightly on the offense. And she likes to weave into her speeches. And that was part of a video. I can't remember which night at the convention that she has, you know, prosecuted transnational gangs and cartels. And in the video, she was at the border probably earlier in her career. But anyway, she understands that this is a liability. So she's answering this vulnerability. And I think that they're thinking about it in a smart way, which is why they had Senator Murphy talk last night about Trump trying to kill that bill. So they know that that's an issue. What I'm hoping is that, first of all, I am critical of Harris for not putting in the work on policy, because I watched it in 2019 and it was lazy and it was obvious. She took 4 positions on Medicare for All. She didn't know healthcare, which was the most important issue to the party. And that stood out. I mean, it was truly embarrassing. Then she has aides who have said that she doesn't do work. And then when she doesn't do a good job, she blames the aides. She doesn't read the briefings. She has this country's, you know, constitutional order in her hands. I really hope she's not going to leave any stone unturned. And I am impressed that she's already practicing for the debate. She is already doing that. And that is really important. What I sensed from the last 4 weeks was she wasn't ready to sit down and answer a lot of questions about Joe Biden's cognitive decline and her role in covering it up until she got this campaign up and running. And for that, I empathize with that. I think that she made the right decision to just go silent on press interviews until she could get kind of put the momentum into the air, move this forward, and then sit down with 60 Minutes and start taking questions about Joe Biden's cognitive decline, which will be part of any interview. So will Iran, and so will all about, you know, these other tough questions. So I believe she's doing the work. I trust that she's doing the work, and she's getting ready because she has a debate coming on September 10th. I think it would be smart, back to your question, to do an interview before the debate. That way, a good debate is another chance to put the interview in the rearview mirror if there are some stumbles in there. But also, the Trump campaign provides something for her to pivot to every single day, not the campaign, the candidate. So today, while we've been on, Meredith McGraw, who has a brand new book out on Trump, has tweeted that Trump tells the Daily Mail he does not want to get intelligence briefings now that he's the nominee, because as soon as I get that, they'll say that I leaked it. So the best situation is to handle that situation is I don't get the briefing. Every single day, if she answers something that she starts taking heat for, or it's a bad news cycle, she will have something like this from a crazy man to talk about. To tell the voters this is a reckless person who doesn't is A, a national security threat, and B doesn't take national security seriously. So I want her to get out and stumble, because it, as Bill points out, it makes you a better horse if you win the race and you gotta be leader of the free world. But I also think she will always have the chance to get to the next news cycle, because Trump is really immolating and really kind of cracking up.
That has always been such a crazy element of the whole Donald Trump experience, that it's such a perfect little vignette there where he doesn't want to be prepared on national security matters because he's worried about this like oblique press coverage angle in how he's treated by the chattering class over here. I mean, it's like you can tell. I mean, that's what he cares about, right? What he cares about is his press clippings. And
Andrew, there's a deep state of intelligence officers briefing him that are then going to leak something from the meeting. So he doesn't want to be president of this country and lead this government because they're a deep state out to get him.
Can I intervene and beg to differ? I am so glad he's not getting the security briefings. Thank God he's not getting the security briefings. You know, when he says these things, he's also projecting. Of course he'll leak what he gets. And so, it's disgraceful that a person running for the president of the United States doesn't want to know what's happening in the world. On the other hand, thank you, Lord.
I agree.
It is very funny to hear him say that he would be falsely accused of leaking when, I mean, that was like a routine news cycle in the Trump administration, was he would be at some bilateral meeting and he'd just say something that had been given to him in a briefing, and it would be like, oh, well, maybe you shouldn't have done that, man. Okay. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again. When Mint Mobile says $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, they mean it. You can say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile's here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan. Bring along your phone number along with all your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/beg to differ. That's mintmobile.com/beg to differ. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/beg to differ. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Okay, so we've talked a lot about Donald Trump, a lot about Kamala Harris. Let's pivot a little bit here. Let's talk about the third guy in the race who's in the news a little bit this week. Because here is one thing that still could shake up this race, at least to a certain extent. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has said he intends to make a big campaign announcement tomorrow when we're taping, today when you're listening. We never really know what that guy's going to do. He's a bit of a loose cannon. Every indication is that the likeliest thing is that he will be suspending his campaign and endorsing Donald Trump. Obviously, this is a very tight race. He has lost a lot of the kind of like early name ID appeal that he had, but he still polls a few percentage points anytime his name is included in national polling. And he appeals to a sort of weird, oblique, cross-partisan, iconoclastic slice of the electorate. So let me come to you, Bill, to ask about what do you make, assuming that is actually what we're going to see tomorrow, assuming RFK Jr. is going to join forces with Donald Trump, does that spell danger for the Harris campaign, or how much does that shake up the race?
Less than one might imagine. At least that's my threshold belief. If you look at the polls, he's already lost more than two-thirds of the support that he had at his peak. It's not clear to me that the remaining 4.5%, that's what it was as of this morning, is going to break clearly in one direction or another. As I've followed the internals of polling since he got into the race, he's been drawing about equally from the two campaigns. He has not been a big difference maker. You know, if you compare polls with him in and with him out, you know, you see a difference of maybe one percentage point, and it's not entirely consistent which direction that is. So it may be that the remaining one-third of his support is much more asymmetrically distributed than the two-thirds that have already departed. We have to keep that in mind. And if it boils down to another really close election, that could make a difference. But I think that an enormous amount of steam went out of independent and third-party candidacies in general when Biden withdrew from the race, because an enormous amount of that was just the expression of voter frustration at the choices that they were confronted with. And so everybody was banging on about double haters. Well, double haters have almost disappeared in the twinkling of an eye, because you now have two pretty satisfied groups of voters, and you know the residuum of dissatisfaction is really not that large anymore. You know, all of that could be dead wrong, you know, if 4 points of the remaining 4.5 of Kennedy's support are all Trump supporters. On the other hand, there's a long history of candidates trying to transfer their support to someone else and not getting very far in the attempt. So I'll end where I began, less than meets the eye. And besides which, I'll just leave this out as a sort of a left coast cultural observation. Apparently his wife, the actress Cheryl Hines, is implacably opposed to his endorsing Donald Trump. She'll never be able to eat lunch in the town again. So he has a major internal hurdle to clear.
Yeah, that has always been such a fascinating thing to me about the RFK campaign, the RFK Jr. campaign, because he has, you know, he is so embedded in his, the Kennedy world that he grew up in. I mean, the world of kind of like affluent, upscale, plugged in Democratic politics. which is 100%. I mean, there is almost zero overlap between that and his political coalition, right? Almost entirely much more kind of iconoclasts, anti-establishment types, conspiracy theories. I mean, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, Sam, because I actually don't know whether you have spent any time on the ground at Kennedy rallies. I went to his launch in Philadelphia months and months ago, or I'm sorry, not his launch. I went to his event where he declared he was leaving the primary and going independent in Philadelphia. And I was just struck by the kind of mosaic of human diversity on display of the people who were kind of, you know, at least a little bit RFK curious. I'm curious what you make of kind of Bill's assessment of the people who were there from the beginning, and then maybe the kind of voter who is still RFK ride or die today.
Although the Kennedy group used to be split pretty evenly between Biden and Trump, now we see that it's mostly Trump voters that would go to Trump should Kennedy exit the race. At least in our polling, in the New York Times, Siena College polls in swing states kind of tracks that as well. There were some Kennedy folks downtown handing out T-shirts in the Loop in Chicago yesterday. And this was about an hour after this news broke that Kennedy will be speaking Friday, maybe endorsing Trump. And I asked them about it, and they said they hadn't seen the news. But all of them said, if Bobby's with Trump, we're with Trump. And as we talked, I heard the same thing that I've heard at Kennedy events over the last couple of months, that there's a real functioning, I think, from grievance that almost mirrors what a lot of Trump supporters would say about their support for their candidate. To a lot of the Kennedy supporters, they think he's been unfairly treated, that he was unfairly treated in the Democratic primary, that he was unfairly treated last week in the courts in New York by being barred from the ballot there, that he's been unfairly treated as he tried to get on these ballots across the country and it hasn't worked out, as ballot operations rarely do. And that's very similar to the way that Trump speaks to his voters and a lot of voters speak about Trump. So I think there's a big parallel there. And if that's the main thing, pulling together this tiny cohort of supporters this late in the race, it's hard for me to see that many folks would say, I agree with Harris on policy, so I'm going to go over to the Harris side if they're not there already.
Yeah, so maybe the cake is sort of baked. But for that reason, I was kind of struck the last couple of weeks. You know, we've had little bits of information trickling out here and there showing that Donald Trump has been courting RFK pretty hard to try to get his endorsement. I mean, the RFK campaign sort of buffoonishly accidentally leaked that phone call between Trump and RFK, where Trump was buttering up RFK's kooky vaccine beliefs that vaccines cause childhood autism. I mean, just very, very much trying to make himself a fellow traveler. Meanwhile, the Kennedy campaign, I believe it was just last week, released or leaked a story about how they had been trying to get meetings with Kamala Harris's team, and how Kamala Harris's team was essentially saying, thanks, but no thanks. You know, we don't really see a lot of daylight here. AB, I'm curious, because I can kind of see this two ways. One is that it would be a totally silly, I mean, just kind of a futile strategic play for Harris to try to make good with Kennedy at all. That nothing good can come of trying to sidle up to a crank and his cranky base of support. And I can also see a case to be made that you don't necessarily want to push the guy, you know, directly into Trump's arms. You would rather have him stick around in the race and peel that still pretty Trump heavy couple percentage points away from Trump in some of these states. I'm curious what you make of how Harris has approached this so far and what you think will happen tomorrow.
I really want to trust Bill, who looks at polling much more closely than I do. But the Trump people began to believe what Samuel just described, which is that it was going to hurt Trump. And so that's why Don Jr. and Tucker Carlson and their business executive friend, Omid Malik, who has donated to both Kennedy and Trump, got together to pull RFK out of the race and convince him to go endorse Trump. And they spoke. Trump and RFK speak on Sunday before the DNC kicks off. And then they met on Monday. This is according to NBC reporting. And so I am concerned because a few points is a lot in this election. And Harris, first of all, I would love to believe that RFK Jr. is going to take his wife's concerns seriously, but he's a really bad guy who's done terrible things to at least one former wife. And I just don't trust him to do the honorable thing and put his marriage first. But also, when you look at Harris, I mean, her brand, right, is like she doesn't do kooky. She's not dealing with weirdos. And as Oprah said last night, we're doing common sense, not nonsense. Okay. So I really think that there's no way for her to like wiggle through to some kind of quasi detente with RFK that doesn't look really bad for her. And he's just a bad guy. He's not just a weird guy. And so I think she needs to stay away from the stank and just take the hit and try to overcome it and try with resources to show that this was, you know, all along, he was just a front for Trump. He was going to do whatever you can to just show that it was like some Elon, right, tech bro nexus that was planting him to take votes from Biden in the end, and of course ended up hurting Trump. So do what you can to trash him, but I don't think you can embrace him. And I don't think you can hold him off. I don't know how in the next, in the next several remaining hours, she convinces him to diss Tucker Carlson and Don Jr. and Donald Trump. So I am nervous about it. And I don't see where I always sort of knew that his candidacy wasn't going to run the tape. I just always had this feeling that he's so messed up as a person that it was never really going to go to the end. But it is not good news that he's trying to make common purpose with Trump and convince other with the remaining, voters he has to actually go to the polls for Trump. That would be, in a numbers game like this, I'm scared of those margins.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right that one of the reasons why he's been able to kind of go this deep in the game without getting a lot of pressure from Trump and the Trumpy base to get out of it is that it was not necessarily super clear before that his staying in the race hurt Donald Trump rather than Kamala Harris, to the extent that it's a lot clearer now that seems to be the case with his remaining supporters. It reminds me, actually, as you were saying, I was reminded of during the Republican primary, Vivek Ramaswamy's campaign, where he also ran this weird kind of tech adjacent, very online, very iconoclastic, very anti-elite campaign from a kind of like class traitor to the elite point of view, and was kind of blessed by Trump all along on the theory that he was going to mostly suck support away from Ron DeSantis. And then when it quickly became clear coming out of Iowa that wasn't true, that if anything, Vivek was going to just keep Trump from getting over 50% in New Hampshire, then the knives really came out and the public pressure campaign, the anti-Vivek stuff started, and he was gone from the race endorsing Trump in just a couple days. So I would not be at all surprised to see exactly that same trajectory play out here for RFK Jr. Linda, what do you make of all this? What do you make of the RFK situation?
Well, I am a little worried. I guess, I absolutely respect Bill Galston. He's my polls guru. But I really think that Samuel is right, that may have been true of his overall base of support when it started. But people who are remaining do seem to me cranks. And that demographic is more likely to go to Trump. What I have a question about, and I don't know if Bill can answer it or Samuel or anybody else, AB or whoever can answer this, but what I wonder is if he drops out, even if he endorses Trump, whether his folks are so obsessed on vaccines, etc., and Trump, though he, has thrown some bones that way, you have to remember Operation Warp Speed was during the Trump administration. That I wonder if those voters simply won't show up. And so, are these likely voters that are still remaining in this 2%? It's a gamble I wouldn't want to take, but I absolutely agree with AB. There's no way that Kamala Harris can, make an appeal to RFK Jr. He is a bad guy. He is a younger, better looking Donald Trump. And that, frankly, is, you know, there's just no way that she can reach out to him. She certainly couldn't do what Trump, you know, has suggested that he would do, and that is offer him a place in her administration. You know, that'd be the end.
Did you have another thought there, Bill?
Just to repeat, we'll find out. But I think that Linda's cautionary note at the end, which echoed something that I said at the beginning, namely the issue of the transferability of loyalty just based on an endorsement, is a very real one. I have listened to a lot of RFK's speeches, and what they have in common with Trump's speeches is a sense of grievance. That's the only thing they have in common, because the grievances are really very different, right? And, you know, and I do think that there is this crunchy granola part of RFK's environmental appeal that is the polar opposite of what, you know, drill baby drill Donald Trump has been banging away on. So look, you know, arguing about what will happen is a mug's game, and we'll find out. It could make a difference, but I'll be skeptical until proven wrong.
Well, I totally agree with you all that it seems very obvious that Kamala Harris herself personally could not have done much to affect whatever's going to happen over the next couple of days. You don't want her sidling up. But the same, I mean, I do kind of wonder, we've had all these different affinity groups coming out for her. Nobody wants to put together a Cranks for Harris call. I mean, nobody wants to put up her 2020 remarks about how you can't trust the Donald Trump vaccine and really lean into the Operation Warp Speed stuff and try to hang that around Trump's neck. You know, it could help on the margins a little bit. Let's not entertain that any longer. Let's do our routine thing here at the end. It's been a very vibes heavy week. I'd like to hear each of your highlights and or lowlights of stuff that's happened in the last 7 days for you. Should we start with AB, we took yours. I accidentally took yours earlier. We'll let you go last, or not at all if you can't think of a single good thing that's happened in the last 7 days. Bill, maybe we'll come right back to you. What's your highlight or lowlight for us?
Yeah, well, my lowlight is something that amplifies the worries about the post-election period that AB, you know, articulated in her first remark. This is not something that just happened, but something that I just was able to confirm. You may recall that in 2020, Pennsylvania was one of the very last states to report its results. And that is going to be an even bigger deal this time. I guess many of the viewers now believe that I've turned into a Pennsylvania nut, but everything I'm seeing suggests that Pennsylvania will be the keystone state in the Electoral College this year. And the reason that Pennsylvania was last to report is that Pennsylvania state law prohibits, you know, vote counters at the county level from even opening the envelopes of mailed-in ballots until every last precinct in Pennsylvania has closed. So that guarantees a long count. And because of the asymmetry in voting habits between Democrats and Republicans, it pretty much guarantees that in a close race, Donald Trump will be, from his standpoint, comfortably ahead by the time most people, you know, go to bed, you know, early in the morning of November 6th. Well, I did a field trip to Pennsylvania just a few weeks ago, and one of the things that I probed was whether that law had changed in the interim. The answer is it hadn't. I asked, why not? Answer, by a whisker, the Republicans control the state Senate in Pennsylvania, and they refuse to go along with a Democratic initiative to change the counting procedure. Bottom line, we are going to see, out of arguably the most important state in the country, the same agonizingly slow vote count that we saw 4 years ago. And I am really, really worried that that will be the entering wedge for something very nasty.
Wow. Yeah. That's I feel like we could do a whole segment on that rather than just keeping it in the low lights. Maybe maybe next week we'll have to talk about it a little more. Linda, can we go to you?
I will just say one thing about that. What it will lead to is lawsuits, and I that causes me great heartburn. So I do have a low light. It's somewhat related to the presidential campaign. It was actually a Wall Street Journal editorial called Systemic Test Racism in Chicago. Chicago Teachers Union President Stacey Davis Gates says Black students can't succeed on tests. And her solution is, let's stop testing. We've been there before. That is a very bad idea. I'll relate it to the campaign to say that it, you know, one of the reasons people were worried about Josh Shapiro as the nominee was that he doesn't have the best relationship with the teachers union in Pennsylvania. And part of that is because, you know, he's a little tougher on some of these things. It would be very interesting to see if the Harris campaign could fashion a message that says that we've got to do better in improving the skills of Black and brown children. In the city of Chicago, I think it's something like 9% of the students are actually proficient in reading, and an even smaller percent in math, or maybe I have those two reversed. But it's really disgraceful. And I think one of the things the Democrats really need, the teachers unions, they are going to be the troops out there, you know, in the campaign. But, you know, my old boss when I worked for the teachers union was Al Shanker. And he was very much in favor of testing. He was very much in favor of knowing what the skills levels were of the students in the classroom. And it isn't that you blame the teachers entirely for it, but you don't give them a free pass either if they can't make improvements. So this might be something that Harris could do, a little unexpected. It would have to be careful, but we do have to worry about the low test scores of poor kids across the board, but Black and brown kids in particular.
AB, do I dare come to you, even though I stole your thunder earlier? Have you got anything for our highlights, lowlights here?
I said to Bill when we did a video yesterday morning, I was really glad to see Doug Emhoff, the first gentleman, talk about how important speaking out against anti-Semitism was to him, and that he did it at the encouragement of his wife. I was, of course, agree with everyone here, thrilled to see the response in the hall to the hostage parents. And I was thrilled that the DNC, according to Sam, has so shrewdly made sure that the protesters are not a part of the coverage of the convention, and they haven't messed up the convention. I had really low expectations for all that. So that was really of a theme, a positive result to me. At the convention, I thought it was going to be a big headache for the convention, and then just obviously more divisive for the Democrats. But back to Trump trying to steal the election, I do want to just say, again, it's really important that this become, you know, a big part of the conversation. What Bill Galston just described was the red mirage that's going to happen in Pennsylvania that happened in 2020, where we knew for weeks that Trump would look like he was winning on election night and Biden could win later. This just needs to be part of the debate. It has to be talked about all the time so that voters are prepared for it. And we need to do a better job than we did. We knew about a red mirage in 2020. We need to do a better job. And we need to make, like I said, Trump's plans, his pronouncements that he has already secured enough votes to be the victor in this election. I'm sorry, this has to be billboards, this has to be headlines, this has to be just a constant refrain that anyone who cares about the constitutional order comes back to. And they have to share it, they have to talk about it, they have to write about it, they have to make their voting plan, like I said, because the more awareness there is, the less power that, you know, the thieves have when they're going to try to start the steal. It's very, very important that they help be held to account. And the more public pressure there is on these county canvassing boards and all of the people who plan to subvert the election, the harder it will be for them to do Trump's bidding. So it's a public awareness campaign is essential.
Sam, highlight, low light, what do you got?
To stick to the same theme of election denialism, I had a conversation earlier this week with Rusty Bowers, who's the former Speaker of the House in Arizona, who was pressured directly by Trump and by Rudy Giuliani to submit a slate of fake electors in that state. And he said he's not voting for Trump this year. He can't pull himself to vote for Harris either. But he said that we should expect Trump to follow the exact same playbook he did in 2020. He said it almost worked then. Why change it? I think was his quote. So that's definitely a low light for me, something to watch, especially in Arizona. I mean, Bill mentioned Pennsylvania, but Arizona is notorious for being incredibly slow on election night to get returns in. Part of that is because in November of every year, they're, you know, two hours behind the East Coast. But beyond that, because of the implementation of mail-in balloting and things, they're just incredibly slow. So we'll be watching Pennsylvania, but we should also watch Arizona and Nevada in the West. A highlight, though, to kind of piggyback off of AB, discussions of anti-Semitism at the DNC have been few and far between. At events outside of the evening sessions, there's been a lot of talk about the rise of white Christian nationalism, but a real, I think, reticence on the part of Democrats to talk about anti-Semitism. And that's been frustrating. And I think that's why last night, the parents of the hostages, and then First Gentleman Doug Emhoff the night before talking about it, confronting it on the stage was really powerful. Moments after the parents of the hostage spoke, I joined a quorum of 10 Jewish men right outside the doors of the United Center who lined up to offer their evening prayers. And they felt comfortable enough to do it outside the doors of the United Center, within the perimeter, the security perimeter, but outside in the open, praying for 10 to 15 minutes. And it was just a beautiful example of religious pluralism, and they were able to do so without any incident. So that would be my highlight.
Yeah, I'm glad you gave us something a little nicer there at the end, because I feel like the trajectory of this podcast has been really remarkable. We started so high with all the great vibes, and it's been a downer parade for the last 20 minutes or so. I will also just go out with one quick highlight, very breezy in one way, but also kind of profound in another, I thought, which was the Tim Walz's speech last night was a great speech. I mean, I like a lot of Bulwark adjacent people did think, for all the Pennsylvania type reasons we've talked about, that Josh Shapiro would have been a good pick for Kamala Harris. But I think when you saw those two politicians up there last night, it's really just hard to argue that going for the kind of folksy guy with the non-elite career trajectory and path and personality and just whole thing going on was hard to argue that was not a smart move on the part of the Harris campaign. And I just the moment that, I mean, I've sat through so many hours of convention coverage this week that you know, it's you kind of get inured to it all. But when he talked about kind of his family's own difficulties with conceiving their children, and he was making a policy point, you know, about, you know, potential Republican dangers to fertility treatments like IVF. But the thing that struck me was just him talking about his family and him singling out his family in the audience. And when it cut to his family, and his teenage son just jumped up and was like beside himself, just crying and kind of pumping his fist for his dad. And like, that moment, that kind of wholesome moment of family decency was so striking to me, and I had all the feels from it. So that was my highlight of the DNC convention, certainly this week. And I've been covering that thing for like 18 hours a day. So I have nothing to say about anything happening outside the convention. So I guess we'll wrap it up there. Thank you, as always, to our regular panelists, Linda and Bill. Thank you, AB, for sitting in, and thank you, Sam, for coming and joining us to give us your insights from the ground. And thanks to all of you for listening to another episode of Beg to Differ. Mona will be back here next week in the captain's chair. Thank you all for putting up with me, and we'll see you next time.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.